Welcome to Ag in Uncertain Times, and today is a national webinar conference, a series of presentations intended to assist agricultural professionals, extension educators, and practitioners prepare for the challenge of developing in agriculture. Today we're offering four separate webinar sessions covering U.S. domestic trade issues and implications for U.S. agriculture, Session B that will look at current conditions and issues facing U.S. crop and forage producers, a third session looking at current conditions and issues facing U.S. livestock and dairy operators, and the last session covering current conditions and issues facing specialty niche crop producers and the trade implications for those types of operations. I'm John Hewitt, an extension economist at the University of Wyoming, and I will serve as your host for the first of today's webinars. But I'm only able to do that through the help and assistance of many others working behind the scenes to make these presentations possible. Our team members come from a number of Western states, and without their support and the support of their institutions, these webinar offerings would just simply not be possible. Again, the intent of Ag in Uncertain Times is to help folks involved in agriculture meet the challenges of the current times and the speed of that change. These presentations may be viewed as live webinar presentations by looking at or viewing the recordings that we make and post of each program, or by accessing the recordings to make, in turn, other presentations to individuals or groups in a subsequent rebroadcast of the material. In today's webinar, we will explore U.S. and domestic trade issues and implications for U.S. agriculture. This will include both financial and economic conditions, global economic health, international financial conditions, governmental policy, as well as effects of those conditions and policies on short-term demand and supply. Further, our presenters will discuss the significant implications for U.S. agriculture in the next 12 to 24 months. Today's presenters include Dr. Gregory Gilpin, Associate Professor of Agricultural Economics at Montana State University, and Dr. Vince Smith, Professor of Agricultural Economics, also at Montana State University. We will provide a more in-depth introduction to each of these gentlemen as we begin the program. First, let me explain how the participants in the webinar can put questions to our speakers. The process we'll follow is to enter in any questions that you might have into a chat window you find at the lower left side of your screen. Once you've typed in your question and click the button to the right to submit, it is conveyed to our background team. These folks organize those questions and feed them to me to present to the speakers at the appropriate time. We would also encourage that if you're experiencing any kind of technical difficulties in participating in this webinar, now, whether those might be audio or some other issue, you might also let us know through that same chat window. One of our team will work with you to try and address those problems as we go along. Today's web conference is yet another in our series since beginning in June of 2009 when we focused on uncertain credit. In total, the Ag and Uncertain Times team has had the privilege of hosting over 50 individual presentations to date. Past programs are available as video downloads or as audio MP3 files. They may be accessed in several ways at our Ag in Uncertain Times website. We invite you to visit the site to access those recordings and other materials following today's presentations. Finally, before we begin the first session of our conference, we would like to point out that if you're having trouble viewing this on-screen slide material, you may click the full screen button to toggle the slides to fill the entire screen on your particular computer. Clicking it again will reveal the chat window and slide materials in a side-by-side format. And now we have a few questions that we'd like to ask members of the audience if they wouldn't mind filling in. This gives us a little better understanding of who it is that's participating in our webinars. The first question is if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your primary occupation, whether you're an agricultural producer, extension educator, banking professional, agribusiness professional, commodity organization employee, other not-for-profit type organization employee, or a government agency employee, or other, if none of those choices actually apply. Thank you for those answers. Next question we have here before us is, what is your main place of business? Where is it located? Is it in the... We skipped ahead to the next question, including yourself. How many individuals are participating in this webinar from your location? Are there one, more than one, ranging from 2 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, 16 to 20, or more than 20? If you wouldn't mind filling that in, it helps us gauge the number of participants. And now we'd like to know, with this last question, just how many people, where it is that your business is located. Are you in which region of the U.S.? Northeast, Southeast, Midwest, Southwest, Western U.S., Pacific Islands, or international? Thank you for filling that out. We'll move now to our first presentation in our webinar this morning, covering U.S. policy conditions. Our first speaker is Dr. Gregory Gilpin. Dr. Gilpin is an assistant professor at Montana State University and received his Ph.D. from Indiana University back in 2009. Upon graduating, he accepted an offer from Montana State University to teach courses in macroeconomics. He enjoys research and has mainly studied the effects of public policy. His research on public school teachers' labor markets have been published in the prestigious Journal of Public Economics and Economics of Education Review, among others. He's currently studying the ballooning student loan market. Greg, I'd like to thank you for joining us this morning, and the floor is yours. Please take it away.
Thank you. It's great to be here and to be able to give a small snapshot of the current macroeconomic conditions. In this presentation, I've decided to look at four pillars of macroeconomics, namely GDP, or total output, and how that is in perspective context in our global economy. I'm then going to go on to discuss unemployment and the labor market conditions. Thirdly, I'd like to go over interest rates, short-term and long-term, and inflationary expectations. And lastly, I'm going to close with a discussion of the federal budget. So first off, the U.S. is approximately about $15 trillion. This is about a quarter of world output. So this is going to give us all goods and services that were produced during the last year relative to other countries. You'll also see on this slide that the Eurozone accounts for almost another quarter, and the Eurozone is going to consist of the 17 countries of the European Union. China, they don't produce as much of either of these two groups, but they are growing roughly at a rate of 6 to 8% per year, which is almost triple to about five times what the U.S. produces in any given year. This substantial growth in China has taken about 46% of GDP going towards investment. This is anywhere, this is about almost about 2.5 times what the U.S. is going to invest in our own economy. And so they're going to continue to take a substantial amount of input resources to grow at that rate. And in particular, they're going to continue to take a fair amount of energy and raw materials. Other than those three large economies, we've got also Japan and Germany, which have on a per capita basis a substantial amount of GDP and output being produced. Now, for U.S., what we can see primarily is that we've gone through a substantial downturn, and the latest data, which I was very glad that I could present to you today, you can see the substantial downturn that occurred in 08 and into 09. And you can also see the recovery that we've been able to recover more than 50% of the decline in output from the most recent recession. So the U.S. has rebounded in terms terms of total output, but it's still going to kind of be persistently sluggish in response to kind of a weak labor market and a weak housing market. The most recent recession was clearly larger than the two previous recessions. So in the table that I presented to you, you can see that the pink bands, that the pink bands are much smaller during the 1990 recession and the 2001 recession compared to our current recession. In terms of duration, we would have to go back at least 50 years, the 1974 recession was somewhat close in terms of duration, at least 50 years for output decline. So, as displayed on the graph, output fell rapidly during the most recent recession, but it has been able to rebound. So this rebound took a tremendous amount of government intervention to safeguard even larger drops. Many of the specific programs are now winding down. However, the public policies aimed at safeguarding the overall economy still remain. So now I want to kind of give you some brief numbers on the current state of the economy. We've had some very robust output growth in the last two quarters. In fact, in the third quarter, we are growing about 1.8%. And then in the fourth quarter, we ended up growing at 3%. This was primarily due to consumption increasing, so household consumption. That increased by roughly 2.1% in the fourth quarter. And in particular, durable goods, which increased by about 15.3%. Now, we've also seen a tremendous amount of growth in exports during the fourth quarter. That grew by about 4.3%. And imports, that was only growing by 3.8%. So we kind of had some net exports being positive in the fourth quarter. However, given the last three quarters of imports being larger than exports, the overall year last year was obviously kind of a net export deficit. So I think all of the data is going to indicate that we are in an expansion, however mild. It is kind of forecasted that this expansion will continue, however not as rapidly as we would like or as rapidly as previous recessions. This is mostly attributed to an extremely weak housing market that's not going to see substantial gains for at least another 8 years in many markets and almost up to 18 years in other markets. Now, I'm excluding ag land prices on this, as those are also somewhat determined by commodity prices. I've been able to also get a snapshot of unemployment, and I'd like to just first present the historical trends. Historically, in the U.S., we've been able to have substantially low levels of unemployment. And in fact, after the early 80s, we've had, on average, about 5.5% long-run unemployment rate. We're currently sitting at about 8.3%, which is quite high for the U.S., but not so high coming out of a recession. So the labor market, it's going to continue to make large gains of roughly 150,000 to 200,000 jobs per month for at least the next 6 months. So it's anticipated that the unemployment rate will go below 8% by November. The data also is going to indicate that unemployment has been persistently high in the most recent recession. So unlike previous recessions where it spiked and it was almost needle-like shaped, we actually have this dull point. So the unemployment rate has been very sluggish relative to other ones. Now, the likelihood of a double-dip recession at this point is quite low, as output and employment numbers are strengthening month after month. In fact, the Federal Reserve, they have just recently in the last couple of days reforecasted their employment numbers to a more happy picture. So the U.S. labor supply in the most recent recession has taken, the labor market has taken advantage of the low opportunity cost to obtain skills during the most recent recession. So you can, many universities, you can see many mature students roaming the halls, and other individuals are obtaining additional certifications and upgrading skills, taking advantage of the low opportunity cost to obtain skills. So this is going to continue to change the structure of our economy to more service-driven. In the last 13 months, manufacturing has attributed to roughly 14% of the job gains, and the service sector is almost going to account for the entire, the remaining amount of about 86%. Now, the manufacturing numbers, they're going to continue to increase as production lines ramp up their output, and also as more U.S. companies bring their production lines home to the U.S. over the next 3 to 6 years. Lastly, we've had a decline of kind of roughly on average 5,000 to 6,000 government employees every month. I don't suspect that this will continue, you know, over a 5-year period, but we are going to see a reduction of the federal government in terms of total employment. It is somewhat good in the sense that government spending is going to directly decrease. Unfortunately, some of these workers are going to go directly into the unemployment insurance line. So, lastly, the individuals who are in the unemployment statistics, what we're seeing that almost 42-43% of those that are in the unemployment statistic have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. So one of the biggest concerns that we have is with the unemployed is that they're unemployed for a longer amount of time, and as they remain out of labor, out of employment, it'll be harder and harder for them to regain entry into a job. That is kind of somewhat demonstrated with the labor force participation rate. So the labor force participation rate, it's going to take a ratio of how many individuals are in the labor force, consisting of those that are employed and those that are unemployed and looking for work, to the total kind of eligible population, which is typically those civilian workforce 16 to 65. As demonstrated on the graph, you can see that we have this inverted U shape, that it rose substantially during the 60s and into the 70s, into the 80s. It's somewhat flatlined during the 90s with a small increase around 1998, and then after 2000, we had our first initial drop, and the first initial drop occurred, and it brought it down from its all-time high of approximately 67%, and it went down to about 66. And now it remained in a steady state there, until around 2008, during the recession, and you can see the decline that occurred during our recession. So we have this substantial drop in the U.S. participation rate. Now, our current participation rate is somewhat equal to that of 1983. So what I get from this data is, while unemployment is falling, we also have to deal with the total amount of participants in the labor force that has declined. Okay. Now I'd like to go on and discuss interest rates. There's a few interest rates that I'd like to go over. I'd like to go over short-term interest rates, and then I'd like to go over long-term interest rates. The federal funds rate is kind of the key short-term interest rate. The federal funds rate is the interbank borrowing rate, and this is directly manipulable by the Federal Reserve by expanding the money supply. The current rate is 0.08. This is sometimes referred to in the media as kind of the lower bound of monetary policy. It is definitely the lower bound, since you can't go below zero on an interest rate for the short run. However, there are other tools to manipulate the loanable funds market. We have been at the lower bound from approximately the beginning of 2009. There was large concern during 2009 when the economy did not respond to a rapidly decline in the interest rate from around 5% per year to zero, that we would enter another recession. However, the economy has taken lift. As displayed on the graph, interest rates have remained extremely low. In fact, we haven't had this duration of low interest rates in the last 55 years. The economy has rebounded, and Ben Bernanke has promised to keep rates low, at least until the end of 2014. His rationale is due to a weak recovering economy, and in particular, a weak housing market. This has permitted and will permit many businesses and households to obtain low rates for investment. Given that the cost of producing in China will be on par with the U.S. at the beginning of 2015, some of these low rates is to encourage businesses to reinvest in America and take their companies from producing in China and retooling various factories here in America and bringing those kind of jobs home. The rates are also going to stay low because inflation is not likely to increase in the short run and somewhat in the medium run. So this next slide that I have is on the long-term interest rates. This is on a 10-year treasury bond, and many of the longer-term interest rates are tied into this particular rate. And as the graph shows, that interest rates haven't risen. In fact, we have a steady decline in interest rates from 07. We had a precipitous drop in 09 that recovered. But however, they're certainly at historic lows. So despite the downgrade by the S&P, the U.S. government debt is still considered to be one of the world's safest investments. As the financial crisis hit in 2008, investors bought U.S. government debt, and they continue to do so, especially with the situation in Europe. The recent trends in interest rates also reflect Federal Reserve's quantitative easing policy and the moderate inflation rates experienced in recent years. At any rate, there's no evidence of a flight from U.S. government bonds, at least not to date. Okay. Now, I'd also like to go over expected inflation rates. The expected inflation rate is currently around 3%. There were some concerns that inflation may increase due to lower interest rates. However, given the current excess supply of labor and other factor inputs, prices will remain low. This implies that the Federal Reserve will be able to maintain low interest rates into the near future without substantial risk to an increase in inflation. The impact of the housing bubble continues to be realized with lower asset prices, lower interest payments on housing assets, and lower cost of living for some. With inflation rates remaining low, as well as low interest rates, these imply that the real cost of borrowing will remain low into the near future. However, it also means that holders of long-term debt may desire to hold shorter duration assets. This directly translates into tighter lending standards as financial institutions trade return for better borrowers. Thus, the supply of loanable funds will remain tight. It is suspected that inflation increase will come directly through energy prices and, in particular, oil prices. This is somewhat out of the control of the U.S. government. While they can promote stability in the Middle East, the market is jumpy and is prone to speculative attacks. Okay. Another measure of inflation that we can get is through the housing price index. One of the most prominent ones is the Case-Shiller Kansas City House Price Index. This graph is clearly going to show the run-up into the housing bubble and then the collapse. This particular graph is indexed for 100 for January 2000. And it also has nominal and real prices. So, first off, we can see that the housing bubble, it primarily started somewhere around the late 90s and early 2000. It grew substantially from 2003 through 2006, and then the bubble started to burst. It didn't burst as rapidly as I would have anticipated, but it had kind of this dull, flat area from roughly 2006 through 2007, and then we saw the rapid decline, and which mostly bottomed, I wouldn't say bottomed out, but lost a lot of its value up until into 2009. After 2009, we had a slight increase. This was mostly from the first-time homebuyer credit, which somewhat buoyed the market. And then you can see after the first-time home market, first-time homebuyer credit expired, you see a slight decline. Housing prices in most markets are not expected in nominal terms to return to the prices of 2006 to about 2020. In some markets, that'll be 2030. Currently, house prices are now less than 5% above their 1990 value. Okay. Lastly, I'd like to talk a little about the federal government budget. The first number that I'd like to bring out is the federal debt number. This has been in the news in terms of trying to understand how large it is and if we're going, if with Congress debating defaulting last year, we had a downgrade roughly because of the size of our debt. What's important to recognize, though, that we have two measures of debt. The first one is total debt, and this will be the total amount of debt that we have accumulated over time, or gross debt. And we also have the debt that's held by the public, or net debt. The difference between these two numbers is how much do we owe ourselves versus how much we owe others. So total debt is going to include the debt that we owe ourselves and the debt that we owe others, while debt held by public, or net debt, only includes the debt that we owe to other individuals. As the graph demonstrates, we had a large decline from its all-time high post-World War II from until around 1980, and then we had an increase and a continual expansion in growth and net debt. During the most recent recession, we've had a rapid increase in debt from around 60% of GDP to approximately 100% to about 105% of GDP. Now, the graph also shows that the debt is increasing because of the fact that our deficits are expanding faster than our economy. That is, our debt accumulation is faster than our output growth. As a percent of GDP relative to other countries, we we are actually not the largest debt holder. Now, in terms of total debt, we certainly are the largest debtor, I should say, with around $15 trillion worth of government debt. However, as a percent of our GDP, in particular net debt, that owed to other people, that owed to other institutions other than ourselves, we're somewhere, I wouldn't say the middle, but we're certainly towards the top, but not the top spot. So Greece has net debt, debt owed to other countries of 140%. They don't have any debt held by any of their own institutions. We also have Portugal, which is around 79%, and Italy, they're around 70%, Ireland, 69%, Spain is quite low at 48%. However, they're included on this graph because of their other issues with their macroeconomy making it difficult for them to finance their debt. And then we can see the U.S. at roughly 62%. And those are 2010 numbers. One of the big questions one has to ask is how much debt is too much? And does the U.S. currently have too much debt? So that question is primarily asked when lenders worry if they won't be or willing or able to pay back its debt. So there's two primary ways that that countries may not be able to pay off their debt. The first one would be a default risk, which is when they're not able to make their payments to their debt. And the second one is inflation risk. That occurs when a country prints money to pay off its debt. So governments are going to resort to paying off debt through printing money when they have no other means of a revenue stream through taxation. The point, though, is that the risk, if it occurs due to outright default or through inflation risk, they're the same, because the value of the interest payments are going down on when lenders lose faith. I've got six countries on when lenders lose faith, and this is on the 10-year bond yield. This is just a snapshot from a couple months ago. I've been able to gather together the what the countries are called the PIGs: Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And I wanted to demonstrate primarily where the U.S. stands in terms of interest rates and where they are relative to other countries that are going through financial crises, in a particular debt crisis. So primarily you can see Germany on the far right, and Germany has a very low interest rate of roughly 2%. This corresponds very nicely to the U.S. interest rate. Now, the other countries that are experiencing financial crisis, they have much higher interest rates. So Greece, they have an interest rate of roughly 26%, Portugal, 10%, Ireland, 8%. So their interest rates are somewhere between 3 to 5 times, or even much larger in the case of Greece, than the U.S. These high interest rates are reflecting mainly default risk, because all the bonds are denominated in euros, and they're not able to inflate away their debt, so there won't be any inflation risk. So we also have wondering if the U.S. has a large amount of debt. And now, in terms of default risk and inflation risk, the U.S. debt is not too much. However, what is clear, though, is that on the U.S. case, we are not including future outlays or promises made to future generations included in the net, in our debt calculation. This is what's mostly concerning on the U.S. side, which is, are we going to be able to sustain the budget that we put forward or promise to future generations? So the Congressional Budget Office continually calculates what's going to happen to revenues and expenditures over typically the next 10 years and over the next 30 years. The graph that I've been able to put together right here primarily shows an expected flat revenue stream of roughly 18%. This has gone down from roughly 22%, and it went down from the Bush-era tax cuts. It also went down because of our most recent recession. So we can see in the graph the declines, and then it's anticipated that from roughly 15% of GDP currently, that after we have a full recovery from the recession, that we are going to have revenue as a percent of GDP go back from 15% to 18%. And given no current policy being conducted on raising taxes, it's anticipated that this tax revenue rate will stay at 18%. Now, the projected revenue line is expected to go down as some of our government programs are winding down to help out during the recession, as well as other things like unemployment insurance outlays going down as well after the recovery. Now, this revenue line is not anticipated to go downward for very long. In fact, it's anticipated that total primary spending is going to go above 25% of GDP by 2035. This is going to be mostly attributed to a substantial increase in Medicare and Medicaid payments, the CHIP or SCHIP payments, which are coming from the government subsidizing low-income households, and Social Security moderately increasing from more baby boomers retiring. Given our current projections, it's quite clear that our debt is not anticipated to fall. In fact, it's clear from the data that we will have larger and larger deficits in the near future without government action. Now, I don't believe that this spending path is sustainable. In fact, I think some of these projections are highlighting the fact that our promises for the future are larger than what we are able and maybe even willing to pay out. So the question then becomes, are we willing to accept, say, a larger tax rate of going from roughly, on average, 18% to 25%. And I think for most Americans, that answer is going to be no, that we're going to want to reduce benefits in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. Now, how do they end up doing that? Well, that's typically done by allowing inflation to erode away Social Security. So that is, instead of doing large cost of living adjustments, we lower those so that through inflation, we're paying out in real terms less and less in terms of benefits towards Social Security in the future. So this is kind of concluding my remarks on this kind of the current state of the macroeconomy. To recap, we have very strong output numbers. We continually have large increases in output. In terms of recovering from our most recent recession, employment growth is occurring. Most of the indicators are quite favorable in terms of overall consumption, durable good consumption. We also have favorable numbers in terms of our export numbers slightly growing. And we also see a return of U.S. companies that have produced abroad back into America. Some of this is being fueled by low interest rates, and I think that the central bank will maintain those low interest rates, and we have favorable conditions for allowing inflation rates, at least in the short run, to remain low and stable. So, John, I'm going to turn the time over to you now.
Okay. Thank you, Greg, for those really great insights. We have time for just a couple of questions from some of our participants, and so we'll take a couple of those now with the idea that we'll follow up with you and our second presenter in our closing segment. One of those questions is, what triggers, in your opinion, are most likely to slow or possibly reverse the mild expansion that you described in the current outlook?
The first one that I'd like to highlight is kind of the gridlock in Washington in terms of discussing policies related to the vulnerable funds market, so or even debt. Last year, Congress decided to debate if they were going to raise the debt ceiling, and that primarily was more show than anything. That caused a tremendous amount of anxiety and uncertainty in the financial market. The stock market's increased in volatility, and then the S&P downgraded U.S. debt from its kind of perfect rating. If Washington continues on a path of kind of almost showboating and not getting to kind of the real issues, and in particular issues for which resolution is already anticipated. Like, we expected to increase the debt ceiling. We're not going to default on U.S. debt. That's clear. Because foreigners, you know, a third of it is owned by foreigners, and we haven't ever defaulted on foreigners owning our debt. Secondly, the housing market is remaining stagnant. So we have some homeowners who they want to see if they can somehow hold on to the houses for them to recover some of the value that they've put into the house. If the housing market remains stubborn in terms of pricing, this could have consequences, longer-term consequences in terms of unemployment and individuals' mobility.
Okay, and clearly timing is very important too, and so any delays or other kinds of uncertainty that they might interject by how they go about acting would really have some potential to impact things as well. Our second question is wondering here by this participant if you could rank the importance to the recovery and the whole sort of upswing of the economy of the following factors. And those factors that they listed were interest rates, unemployment, U.S. housing market, foreign economic activity, and then other in general, et cetera.
I think most economists would suggest that labor is our precious resource that we have. And so I would primarily first put unemployment or the employment of individuals. That's important for recovery in terms of goods being produced. And then secondarily, I'd probably put interest rates, because that is the driving mechanism for investments. When we have low rates of interest rates, we can get investments, get production lines back online, retooled, get workers back to work. However, I still think that laborers and individuals and their ability to become employed and matched to the best job possible for them is key for recovery.
All right. Well, thank you again for your thoughts. I believe in the interest of time, we should probably move now to our next presenter. Second up this morning in our first webinar session is Dr. Vince Smith. Dr. Smith is a professor of economics in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University and co-director of Montana State University's Agriculture Marketing Policy Center. He received his Ph.D. from North Carolina State University in 1987 and his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Manchester in 1970 and 1971. Dr. Smith's current research program examines agricultural trade and domestic policy issues with a particular focus on agricultural insurance, agricultural science policy, domestic and world commodity markets, risk management, and agricultural trade policy. He's authored and edited 9 books and monographs and published over 140 articles and book chapters on agricultural economics, agricultural policies, and other economic issues. In 2008, he became a distinguished scholar of the Western Agricultural Economics Association, and in 2011, he received the Bruce Gardner Award for outstanding contributions to the economic analysis work of the United States Department of Agriculture. Further, I've been privileged to work with Vince on a number of projects over the last several years and can attest that he's not only very knowledgeable on the subject of U.S. ag policy, but is also able to make presentations on this very complex material in a manner that is understandable by lay people, a claim not every agricultural economist can make. So thank you, Vince, for joining us this morning, and we will now turn it your way.
John, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm going to focus more narrowly than Greg did on one area of policy, and that's agricultural policy. And we're going to look at what may happen over the next few months and the next year. And the central question here is, will there be a new farm bill in 2012 or will it be 2013? And the truth is, we still don't know whether we will have a farm bill even today. There are conflicting straws in the wind about this issue. For example, Senator Stabenow, the chair of the Senate Ag Committee, is holding hearings and is trying to move a bill forward and hopes to have a Senate bill up and ready to go for the House to look at by really the end of this month or mid-April. The problem with that that position is that in the news yesterday, one of the key members of the Senate Ag Committee said, well, let's hope we can get the agricultural bill attached to another bill, which means that the leadership in the Senate and the leadership in the House, and I'm talking beyond the Senate and House Ag Committees, actually are not willing to schedule time in Congress for the committee to present the bill. So we really don't know what's going to happen. I think what we do know is that if nothing happens substantively by Memorial Day, then we won't see a new farm bill this year. We will have one next year. And if that happens, we're going to see an extension of the current farm bill, but probably not at the funding levels that have been scheduled for this year. Probably we'll see $2.3 billion taken out of the current spending, and likely that will all come in reductions in direct payments. Direct payments are very much under fire right now for reasons I'll talk about in a few minutes. The truth is this is a difficult policy environment for farm groups to put forward farm bills that have more funding, and we actually know from negotiations between the Congressional Agricultural Committees and the Super Committee that was supposed to implement serious deficit reduction last year, that spending in farm bill efforts is going to decline by at least $23 billion. The reason why the Senate and House Ag Committees want to get moving on a bill this year is that they surely believe that cuts will be much larger next year if the farm bill doesn't pass this year. Along with a new farm bill, if and when it develops, that farm bill will have major changes in farm programs. We'll talk about those in a few minutes. Well, what makes the policy environment tough? well, exactly the issue that Greg was talking about just a few minutes ago, and that's the federal budget deficit. But there are other problems, and there's skepticism about the need for farm subsidies in Congress and elsewhere, beyond the committees, not within the committees. One issue is record farm gate prices. How can we justify subsidies when the truth of the matter is that we've had 4 years of, from a moderately medium to long run perspective, record farm gate prices in real terms. And we've had record farm incomes to go along with that. And we have, it increasingly well known, the concentration of farm program benefits is among the largest farms and the wealthiest farmers and landowners. 80% of all revenues from subsidies go to the essentially the 15% largest farms, all of which makes life a little more difficult. And we've had public and media resentment and disapproval over the direct payments program, which is increasingly viewed as a something-for-nothing program, which, again, disproportionately is perceived to go to the wealthier and wealthier farmers and landowners. And that perception is pretty accurate. Just a couple of quick slides. These show that nowadays farm operator household incomes are higher and have persistently been higher over the past decade than the average U.S. household income. We're looking at median here, but average numbers show even greater disparity. We see that the incomes of full-time farmers, and those are really people who are producing about $250,000 or more of product, are really very high. Just from farming, well over $100,000 in household income. And because many of these operations, the husband and wife both have jobs, one off the farm, we're looking at incomes that among those larger guys who get most of the subsidies, in 2011, they got over $200,000 in household income. That creates a little bit of a political problem when the same people come back to Congress and ask for subsidies. The wealth situation isn't favorable for farming anymore. We're not in the world of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath in the 1930s. Farmers are on average about six times wealthier than the rest of the country. So that all makes life challenging. We also have an issue that congressional delegations, especially in the House, from non-farm districts and even states, are unsupportive of farm programs, not least because they want to protect other programs that benefit the people who vote for them. We only have about 33, 34 congressmen who have more than 5,000 farms in their districts. It's a very small number. And we have about 400 people in the House who are much more concerned with nutrition and other programs. We also have disagreement among the major farm groups about what programs should be on the table for cuts, how large cuts in specific programs should be, what new programs should be introduced. We have very different proposals from, for example, the Farm Bureau than from cotton or rice. There's disagreement among House and Senate Ag Committee members about the same issues. In fact, we know the Senate cannot get its act together on a consistent view of what should happen. And there's some key players who have very different views. And outside of the House and Senate Ag Committees, we have the Tea Party particularly being important in the House. And that's creates uncertainty about what the Republican leadership wants to do in terms of budget issues, not to mention, of course, presidential candidates. And it's not at all clear where, especially in the House, the world is going with respect to budget and availability of budget for agricultural programs. And behind all of this, there's the federal budget issue, which Greg laid out very clearly. This is a shorter run picture of the budget deficit issue. Roughly, we're looking at discussions about cutting budgets, reducing deficits, over the next 10 years. That's the frame of reference for any deficit reduction effort, and that was the frame of reference for the super committee last year. Well, what you can see is that we're running a deficit, and we're going to run that deficit for the next 10 years, absent policy change. And the red line shows what's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office to be happening to the budget deficit. And it's going to run at about $600 billion to $800 billion over the next 10 years, according to their estimates, if nothing is done substantively, either on the tax or the tax side, which is the revenue side, or the spending side. The super committee was trying to develop a $2 trillion deficit reduction, and that is a big number that doesn't mean a lot by itself. What it really means is an annual cut in the federal deficit of about $200 billion. That's a third to a quarter of the estimated CBO deficit. So, in fact, it's not much. And everybody admitted that fact. And, in fact, President Obama has proposed that there should be a policy that doubles the size of that cut in the deficit. And that, by the way, is a view at least shared by the House Budget Committee, chaired by Congressman Ryan from Wisconsin. An across-the-board cut in all federal spending would reduce total farm bill spending only by $15 billion, because the farm bill is a relatively small proportion of total spending, and if you just do the numbers, that's what it comes out at. Nobody believes that there'll be merely a $15 billion cut in total farm bill spending. The minimum number everybody agrees on is $23 billion. A readjustment in finances that would really remove the structural deficit would require reductions in annual deficits of $600 to $800 billion, and that would have to happen through tax increases and spending cuts. As Greg pointed out, we don't like tax increases. Not so clear we like spending cuts either, especially if we're elderly. All you have to do is watch your TV for an hour, and you see adverts from essentially AARP, advocating no cuts in Medicare. But what would serious deficit reduction mean? Well, tax increases for everyone, not just Governor Romney from his 13 or 14%, or Speaker Gingrich, or President Obama, but from everybody. It would mean entitlement cuts, meaning there would have to be cuts in Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, probably some cuts in defense. It'd be tough stuff. Reductions in Social Security payments, as I said, Medicare and Medicaid, and very substantial cuts in many discretionary programs, including Farm Bill programs, probably up to, for Farm Bill programs, at least 10, perhaps even $15 billion a year. Essentially, the government would get out of subsidizing commodities pretty quickly. Now, is that likely to happen? No, because we're not going to get that sort of deficit reduction. But a more substantial deficit reduction number, like $4 trillion, $400 billion a year, would put a lot of pressure on the budget for farm programs. Effectively, out of the $23 billion that is the current number being discussed in terms of total 10-year spending reduction, only $18 billion would come out of farm-oriented programs. Bigger cuts would be required, as I said, if Congress and the administration became more serious about deficit reduction. That could well happen next year, by the way. Not this year. No one believes anyone wants to talk about raising taxes or cutting spending seriously this year. But next year is a completely different story, as you will have a president who's got 4 years to work with. You will not be in an election year for the House. And people are going to take the world a little more seriously then than now. What's the current agricultural policy set? Well, it's a very small part of total government spending. But as we see over the next 5 years, on discretionary spending, of which agricultural spending is a part, there's going to be pressure because of an increase in the net interest that the U.S. has to pay on its debt. And that increase is estimated to be substantial, even though U.S. interest rates remain low. Within the farm bill world, where is farm bill money being spent? Well, as everybody pretty much knows, most of the budget in the farm bill is for food and nutrition assistance. In 2010, we spent $93 billion on food stamp or SNAP programs, the WIC, Women and Infant Children program, and so on. And we spent about $20 billion on programs oriented to providing income for farmers. Now, that's a bit misleading because about $3.5 billion of that $20 billion goes straight to the crop insurance companies, and that's an issue that apparently nobody wants to address at this point. It's ironic that 15% of farmer-oriented payments go to the crop insurance industry. What are the payments by major program? Crop insurance is the elephant in the room. Currently, we're spending $7.5 billion, and that's estimated to continue or increase a little. Direct payments are around about 25% of total outlays, and the rest of the world is relatively modest. The other big programs have been conservation programs, $3.45 billion in 2010, and disaster programs, and that's mainly the SURE program, which is almost surely gone because there's no budget for it beyond 2011. But if you take a quick look at these figures, you can see that the loan rate programs don't really matter a lot. Why? Because corn is selling for $5, $6 a bushel, and the current loan rate is in low $2 range. Wheat is in a similar place, with wheat selling for $6 or $7 a bushel, and its loan rate down at $2.92, and so on. The milk and tobacco programs, which is mainly milk, is estimated to take between $750 million and $1 billion a year. It's not clear what the future is for the milk program, and I'm not going to comment on milk policy at all today because that's being discussed later. What do we see as policy trends and possible changes? Well, overall spending on farm programs under the current discussions is going to be cut by about $1.8 billion a year if a farm bill is passed this year. If not, that number may be very different. It may be twice as much, maybe even more than that. Nutrition would be cut by $0.5 billion a year. At least that's the story. The claim is that the savings in nutrition will be because of reduction in fraud through greater enforcement. It's not really clear this is going to happen. And half a billion over $92 billion is a very small percentage. Cuts could have been larger because the White House has proposed a $32 to $33 billion cut. Earlier in July of last year, the House budget chair proposed close to a $50 billion cut, essentially just abolishing direct payments. What are the key proposals, however? There are proposals for new programs because we know that direct payments are gone. Everybody from the Farm Bureau through the corn growers agrees that the direct payment program is almost certainly going to end. Why? Because it's politically a toxic program. It's not a sellable program anymore. That's about $4.9 billion a year. If they only have to cut about $1.8 billion out of farm-oriented programs, that gives the Senate committee about $3.1 billion to play with for new programs. We know the disaster payment program is gone. That doesn't help in terms of giving money for new programs because there were no funds scheduled for that program in what's called the Congressional Budget Office baseline. The ACRE program is also likely to be gone. But as I think many people know, the farm groups want to replace the ACRE program with what are called shallow loss programs, which are really the SURE program coming back in a slightly modified form. So we're seeing commodity-specific programs being introduced with shallow loss programs for wheat, corn, soybeans, and some other commodities. The STAX program for cotton is really a shallow loss program coupled with an adjustment in the loan rate that the cotton lobby hopes will get them out from under the Brazil WTO case. Brazil's already said it won't, and USDA has admitted that the stacks program won't get you really out of trouble with the WTO if you're a cotton producer. The countercyclical payments program is gone almost surely. The push for, particularly from rice and peanuts and cotton, is particularly rice and peanuts, is for higher support prices. That's run into a buzzsaw in the last month, by the way, that proposal for higher support prices. So direct payments will go. The Farm Bureau has voted to get rid of them. Only rice and peanuts and cotton really want to keep them, although everybody says, oh, they're vital, but that's really the game in town. They are a public relations nightmare for the ag sector right now. In fact, in super committee negotiations behind closed doors, farm groups were told by congressional leaders if they wanted to keep direct payments, total cuts would be $40 billion, not $23 billion. In other words, the super committee put a gun to the head, if you like, of the chairs of the Senate and House Ag Committees over direct payments. The ACA program's gone, but to be replaced by a shallow loss program, or if the Farm Bureau had its way, a more heavily subsidized, deeper loss program on the insurance side. Shore program is gone. Countercyclical payments program will be gone. Now, the countercyclical payments program has very few supporters because it's generated almost no income for its original proponents, which were corn, wheat, and soybeans. If a program isn't generating subsidies, why have it? Interesting, the CRP is going to have about $500 million cut in its funding. The reason is straightforward. The farm groups have recognized that many producers want their land out of the CRP because it's more profitable for them to have that land in the production of crops when corn is at $6 a bushel and wheat is at $7 a bushel. The Conservation Stewardship Program is likely to have a cut in funding, although people like Senator Hagen would like to maintain it and even increase funding for it. But the evidence is that the CSP has almost no impact on the environment, because mainly it's requiring people to do things they're already doing and then paying them for it. So there's weak support actually within USDA outside of the people managing the program for that program. Nutrition programs, minimal cuts, as I've suggested. But EQIP is very popular with all farm groups, is widely viewed as actually having a real effect on the environment, and likely to stay, and at current funding levels, or possibly even increased funding levels. The loan rate programs, we would have thought they would have gone a year ago, but they're going to stay in place, probably now with no change in loan rates. Except for cotton, where the loan rate might be reduced some if cotton lobby gets its stacks program, which is a shallow program. We're not sure how R&D spending will fare. Everyone in the administration is saying we need to do very substantially increase public R&D funding targeted to on-farm productivity, but we're still not quite sure what will happen there. And then we've got these new programs taking between $3 and $4 billion that the committees see as available to them to spend, mainly on the shallow loss programs, and they're being proposed by many commodity groups. You've got the Farm Bureau's proposal for expanded insurance, but the commodity groups do want different things, as I said earlier, and that's causing a lot of upset stomachs, if you like, within. Especially the Senate Ag Committee, whose members have different constituencies. One farm program idea that's not come out of the committee is simply to give everybody free crop insurance at 70% coverage for all program crops and do nothing else, which would pretty much take up most of the $3 billion that the Senate and House Ag Committees believe they could spend this year on new programs. Another way to go is to reform the crop insurance delivery system. However, the secretary has recently said that's not going to happen, and so have a couple of key members of the Senate Ag Committee. Although it is a very costly program, we're spending $1.44 on the insurance industry to deliver about $1 of subsidy to the farmers, which in the long run isn't a sustainable way to go. Other ideas that have been put forward but are still on pretty much on the shelf is to go to a whole farm conservation program where you wrap together CRP, CSP, and EQIP. And then we do have a push for more R&D spending. And that sort of describes the landscape of where we are on farm programs. And with that, I'll stop talking and respond to questions.
Well, Vince, thank you very much for your thoughts and for taking time to share those with us today. We have several questions that have come in for you from the audience. I'll give you just a couple of those, and we'll move to a more general Q&A kind of session. The first question is, what is the outlook for food distribution programs, or those that cover commodities purchased for the food banks?
Confused. We have a push by the local foods lobby to generate both organic and non-organic local foods being bought by USDA and given to the food banks. It's not clear how far down that road we will go. But beyond that discussion, there's not a great deal of discussion about, for example, increasing the budget and so on. There have been discussions about using the SNAP program to subsidize things like vegetables and fruits more heavily than other commodities. There have been several congressional delegations who have been interested in that issue. But the overall budget for those programs, I'm not really aware of much discussion about level there.
Okay, thank you for that. Another question has come in from one of our participants. It's asking if you might take a minute to just explain a little more about how a shallow loss program might work if one were put in place.
Oh, by all means. Well, the reason I didn't go through it is that it's a 20-minute discussion, and I'm not sure. But essentially, most of these programs say, let me give a description. Suppose your per acre average revenue for, say, corn over the last 5 years has been $800. Now suppose 90% of that, therefore, is $720. If this year your estimated average revenue falls below that $720, say to $600, you would get paid 60% of the difference between 720 and 600. So that would be around about $70 per acre that you planted. That's roughly how the program would work. The program is capped in the following sense, that it covers shortfalls between 90% and 75% of your five-year average income. Thereafter, you're assumed to have crop insurance to pick up the deep losses. And of course, crop insurance is subsidized at a pretty typical rate of between 50 and 60% of the actuarially fair premium. So it's hard to justify a shallow loss program that overlaps with that sort of coverage.
Okay, well, that helps quite a bit. And now I think we'll move to the general Q&A of both of our speakers from this morning's presentations. So, Greg, if you're still online, well, I'll direct a question your way. It's come in here. It runs along this line. What might be the impact on employment, given your points about its contribution to the general economy? So what's the impact on the employment and the economy if the supply of refined oil declines? For example, if a refinery went offline or several refineries or there was an interruption in oil supplies?
So the
U.S. has become a net exporter of refined products. In fact, last year was our first year that we exported almost all types of refined product. So we're getting, we bring in a substantial amount of crude, and then in Louisiana, mostly we refine and take it out. I don't suspect that on the refining side that we're going to have too many interruptions. I believe we had one in the Northeast. However, I don't necessarily suspect that any closures of our refineries are going to have substantial impact than what we already have on the current state of the economy. We are obviously going to have more volatility. Prices are going to go up and go down. However, last year we saw a little bit of unseasonably lower prices in refined products, even after some of the refineries went offline in kind of a baffling sense. But I don't suspect a large impact at all on employment with refineries going on and offline this particular spring time.
Okay. Another question for you, Vince. It's a little more in-depth, maybe, but the questioner asks, what changes in production ag do you see if there's no new farm bill, or if the current farm bill happens to get continued, or possibly where the farm bill might actually revert back to prior legislation?
Let me deal with the last issue first. There's no likelihood of a reversion back to the 48 bill. We'd be looking at and we'd have to adjust, say, the wheat loan rate to $10 or $11. Two problems with that. If it's an open-ended loan rate, the cost would be enormous. Alternatively, if there were a limited amount of money, there'd be huge fights over who gets the amount of money allocated to the loan rate program. So there's no likelihood, I believe, of a reversion to the 48 bill. The most likely outcome right now, if there's no new farm bill, is an extension of the current farm bill for 1 year. I believe with about a 50% cut in direct payments, and that of course will affect the program commodities rather than the non-program commodities. So it'll affect wheat, corn, soybeans, and so on, but not fruits and vegetables. In terms of actual production decisions, there'll be almost no impact on farmers' decisions about what crops to produce. Those will be driven mainly by market signals that come out of the futures market for the major commodities like corn and wheat, and farmers' expectations about prices for other commodities where there aren't well-functioning futures markets. So very little impact at all on farmer decisions relative to what they would otherwise have been. We don't know what farmers would do with a new farm bill because we're not sure what that farm bill would look like even at this stage. The farm bill would take monies away from the direct payments program, which has minimal impacts on production decisions, and shift it into shell or loss programs, which actually will make the production of program commodities more lucrative. So we'll actually see a switch to production-based incentives for those program commodities. So at the margin, and we're talking about very small effects, I suspect, but at the margin, the program crops will become more lucrative relative to the non-program crops.
Okay. And now, Greg, not to leave you out, here's a question that might range a little deep as well. In your opinion, at what point or range of conditions would consumer debt, which includes student loans, impact the economy here in the U.S. either positively or maybe negatively?
At what point? Is this with reference to time or with respect to debt load?
I think we're talking about magnitude, yeah.
Magnitude?
Mm-hmm.
Household debt loads have continually fallen during the most recent recession. Some of this is households either defaulting on debt or paying down debt. Household kind of liquid asset accumulation has increased as well. In fact, after the recession ended, households have continually saved in terms of liquid assets like cash, checking, and other currency-based assets. I suspect that in the future that we're going to continue to have slightly higher rates of savings, primarily because this younger generation has kind of entered the workforce during one of the worst times in the last 50 years, and this is going to have a substantial impact on their long-run savings rate and their willingness to take on debt. I suspect that the debt levels in the U.S. will remain somewhat high and that they're not likely to go down by substantial amounts, primarily because of our custom to the consumption level, which we're now presently in. On student loans, this is going to be kind of maybe the next somewhat mild financial crisis if it did hit. Primarily debt loads for college-educated individuals have risen substantially. Some of this is attributed to the total tuition levels rising rapidly, roughly around 5 or 6% per year. We also have issues with individuals and their willingness to work during the latter years of high school and during the summer months of college. That participation rate has fallen significantly. And we also see parents willing to contribute more towards the child in terms of their debt, taking on debt to see their children get through college. All of these kind of exasperate the student loan market and make it quite large. And then that in turn also, as I spoke to earlier, that will in turn have an effect back onto life decisions such as when to buy a house, when to get married, when to have a first child.
Okay. So thank you for that. I guess we have one final question of Vince. Vince, questioner here is asking, what do you see might be the impacts on the corn ethanol picture given the current high commodity prices?
Well, we're going to see a continuation of some problems for the older ethanol plants that are really very inefficient operations given relative to current technologies. But really, the ethanol market is actually going to be driven by the ethanol mandate. And as long as Congress holds to the current time path for the ethanol mandate, production of ethanol will have to be expanded pretty much every year. But we actually know that the U.S. has no capacity to meet the current mandate for bio-diesel/bioenergy-based non-ethanol, non-standard ethanol production. We know that the U.S. cannot do that. We know that switchgrass doesn't work and isn't being, and so we're not getting cellulosic ethanol being produced. That seems to be a pipe dream that researchers from Michigan State hold on to. We know that's not going to work. So we know there are going to have to be changes in the ethanol mandate, and those changes, if the current aggregate level of mandate for ethanol use is maintained, mean a shift back to more corn-based ethanol production in the U.S. The only other alternative is to import sugar-based ethanol from Brazil, and it will be a cold day in the nether region before that is likely to happen, I think. So the bigger question for ethanol production and for the price of corn is whether Congress will continue the renewable fuels mandate, and especially whether it will continue the renewable fuels mandate along the time path that's currently laid out. If the mandate went away, we'd still see roughly 8 to 10 billion gallons of ethanol produced every year, because that's the amount that's required to replace MTBE, which is a lower-cost way of getting the additives the fuel needs, but has clearly had health implications. So if the latter case held, we would see producing ethanol close pretty quickly. And all the production would be located in plants built within the last 4 or 5 years. Now, we really don't know what's going to happen to the renewable fuels mandate. That really is contingent on what happens in November. If we got a Republican president and a Republican Senate and a Republican House, my bet is that the ethanol mandate would disappear very rapidly. If we reelect President Obama and the Senate remains Democratic, and let's say the Democrats improve their position in the House, that's a different story. Although there is concern among the left, and particularly among the conservation movement, about the carbon footprint gains from corn-based ethanol relative to oil. So that world's, I think, a pretty murky world for the future, but really contingent on the political decision about where to go with the renewable fuels mandate.
I'm afraid that we've run out of time, so I want to take this opportunity to thank both Dr. Gilpin and Dr. Smith very much for an outstanding presentation on U.S. and domestic trade issues and the implications for U.S. agriculture. I'm confident that many, if not all, of our listeners have really benefited from your insights. And I'd like to remind everyone that as we move to wrap up this first session in today's webinar conference, that the recordings, both audio and video, of this presentation, as well as the remainder of our presentations today, will be available at our website. In addition, we invite you to consider participating in one or more of the upcoming sessions today, which will cover crops and hay, as well as forage outlook, outlook for livestock and dairy, and specialty, niche, and food safety issues for folks involved in that sector of agriculture. As mentioned earlier, those recordings of our presentations and other information are available at Ag in Uncertain Times, the website set up for hosting these programs, which will provide additional instructions on how to access in just a minute. If you're interested in a copy of any of today's presentation slides, those are also available at the site for download. We would also like to hear from you, our participants, about topics or presentations you'd like to see offered in the future. Either send us an email via the email address that's on the screen, westrme@wsu.edu, or type in the chat box there on the left side of your screen, and we will receive that and appreciate any insights that you might offer to our team for future topics. Finally, as we've mentioned a number of different URLs and different email addresses throughout this webinar, in order to provide you with a single reference for all that information, we've compiled a PDF file which you may now download via the file share pod on your screen. Simply click on the file name listed and then click the Save to My Computer button at the bottom to download the file to your own desktop. Let me close by again extending our thanks to both of today's speakers for their first-class presentation on U.S. and domestic trade issues and the implications for U.S. agriculture. I also want to thank our Ag in Uncertain Times team and their sponsoring institutions for making this series possible. We would like to thank, finally, all the participants in today's webinar conference. The next of today's sessions will begin at the top of the hour, and the times for all of today's sessions are posted at the Ag in Uncertain Times website. We hope to see you again on one of our upcoming programs. Until then, we offer you our sincerest hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. And for Ag in Uncertain Times, I'm John Hewlett.